This is Mike Rizzo with ESPN West Palm today, and joining me now is a very special guest. It is Dr. Raphael Judah-Wald, a neuropsychologist with Marcus Neuroscience Institute, part of Baptist Health South Florida. Now, recently, a story that we saw come across our desk was from Robert Klemko. Robert Klemko writes for ESPN.com, and he specifically talked about how NFL players are four times more likely to die from neurodegenerative disease. Now, obviously, Dr. Wald, he is our expert. This is why we're bringing him in. We're going to ask him all of the questions relating to this, but I wanted to bring him in now. Dr. Wald, everything going good today? Partner, thanks so much for joining me.
Everything is great. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Let's get right into it, because obviously with what you do in your field, I'm assuming you had some reactions to finding out that NFL players were nearly four times more likely than the general population to pass away from neurodegenerative diseases. What was your first reaction when you read that in Robert Klemko's article?
But the truth is, my reaction was kind of muted. Definitely not shocked, and I would say that probably most people in the neuroscience community would not be terribly shocked by the news. It's something that we've had a pretty good idea about for a long, long time, and it sort of puts a number on it, and that number four times can be pretty shocking to see. But probably most doctors, most neurologists, neuropsychologists are not terribly shocked, unfortunately.
Now, Dr. Wald, what are some neurodegenerative diseases and which conditions were you most commonly identified among the former NFL players in this study?
Sure. So neurodegenerative diseases are just diseases that involve either the brain or the nerves of the spinal cord. You know, neurodegenerative doesn't just mean brain. It can also be other diseases like ALS, which doesn't theoretically specifically target the brain. It targets the nerves that sort of eventually come out from the brain. So it's any disease that just gets worse and worse over time and generally, unfortunately, ends in death, usually because of complications of that disease. So that's what neurodegenerative refers to. Usually when people think about the NFL and think about neurodegenerative diseases, with all of the media attention lately, everybody's been thinking about CTE, and that's been going on for a long time. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy is when a person suffers numerous head injuries over time, and that eventually leads to changes in their memory and their behavior. But in this case, it doesn't just mean CTE. Unfortunately, it really does increase your risk for a lot of different neurodegenerative diseases.
Dr. Raphael Judah-Wald, a neuropsychologist with Marcus Neuroscience Institute, part of the Baptist Health South Florida Network, is our guest here on ESPN West Palm today. Now, Doc, how might repeated head impacts contribute to the development of things like dementia, Parkinson's disease? You mentioned ALS or maybe other neurological conditions later in life. So how might, you know, all that impact, you know, the head injuries impact those unfortunate diseases later on in life?
So there's a lot of different ways that it can impact it. One of the ways that it can do so is it sort of speeds up the clock for a lot of people. So the reason that a person might develop Alzheimer's disease, for example, it's a very complicated process and it's very multifactorial. There's a lot of things going on, but basically the brain is under stress. And when the brain is under stress, it becomes more prone to have these sorts of breakdowns and to develop something like Alzheimer's disease. So in a sense, a lot of times what happens with something like Alzheimer's disease, for example, or Parkinson's disease, is that the brain is under stress, so it can kind of, you know, speed up the clock for when a person would develop dementia like Alzheimer's disease, like Parkinson's disease. So, you know, if a person, maybe they were predisposed and they might have developed dementia, Alzheimer's disease in their late 80s, this might speed up the clock a little bit, and then, you know, now it's happening in their late 50s or in their 60s. It also just generally makes the brain more vulnerable to different processes that we know are very, very bad for the brain, like inflammation and changes in how parts of the brain communicate with each other. So it basically just puts you at risk in general because of all of the trauma that it experiences, and it kind of ages your brain.
Now, Dr. Wald, is the number of, you know, impacts to the head potentially more important than the numbers of maybe a diagnosed concussion? when it comes to player experiences and dealing with this?
There's absolutely no doubt about that. There's not, you know, we think about concussions, we talk about concussions. Concussion means that a person suffered some kind of a head injury and there was a change in their mental status. So, you know, they weren't thinking the same way, their memory was affected, they lost consciousness, they became confused. So that's what we think of when we think of a concussion. But one thing, first of all, a lot of concussions are minor or they don't get diagnosed. And also, one thing that people don't pay enough attention to is subconcussions. And that's when a person suffers a head injury, but they don't really develop any noticeable symptoms of concussion, which are very concerning. You know, people are surprised to hear that a sport that is very, very prone to concussions, and especially subconcussions, is soccer. Everybody knows about football. Everybody knows about the concussion risk with football. But soccer is also another sport that is people are really prone to concussions. You know, heading a soccer ball over and over and over again is not good for your brain. It may not cause symptoms of concussion at the time, but unfortunately, you know, you are, you know, hitting your head on something to a degree that affects your brain. So there's a lot of different ways that these head injuries are appearing. Sometimes they're noticeable, sometimes they're not, and sometimes they're diagnosed, and sometimes we just can't diagnose them because we don't know they're there.
Dr. Rafael Judah Wald, a neuropsychologist with the Marcus Neuroscience Institute, which is part of the Baptist Health South Florida Network, is our guest here on ESPN West Palm today. Now, Doc, the study found that players who died before the age of 60 had more than 12 times the expected rate of neurodegenerative death. How concerning are these findings?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat it. It's very, very concerning. It's not surprising, I guess, right? If you hit your head over and over and over again, even if, you know, you didn't have the diagnosed concussions, it's going to have an impact. Your brain doesn't really work the same way that your muscles do. If your muscles get hit over and over and over again, you know, your muscles will heal and they can get back to the place that they were beforehand. Obviously, joints and orthopedic injuries are a different story because those cause wear and tear over time as well. But, you know, it's not like a bruise to, you know, your thigh or a bruise to your arm. Over time, cumulatively, you know, this really has an impact that you can't shed. So the impact of numerous concussions one after another, or as I mentioned, subconcussions, are really concerning. It's something that we've seen being taken a lot more seriously lately, but you know, you can only control so much.
Now, Dr. Wald, why do some of these neurodegenerative diseases appear years or even decades after a player's football career has ended? Like you mentioned, sometimes, you know, there are the subconcussions that maybe the players don't realize. Like why does this take years and even decades to kind of actually find out there's something wrong in symptoms? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. As the brain ages, it becomes less able to sort of fend off problems that are coming onto it. So one of the major reasons that people develop dementia and develop other kinds of neurodegenerative diseases is because their brain is less capable of fending off against something called free radicals. These are, you know, sort of these harmful entities that show up in our bodies, and we're capable of neutralizing them when we're younger because our bodies just generally function better. As we get older, our central nervous system, our brain, the rest of our body can't really neutralize and stop these free radicals from causing the effects and the harm that they do. So as we get older, we're just more susceptible to the issues that began years and years ago, which is why, you know, if you had an older person that was to suffer a series of concussions, they would probably develop the neurodegenerative process very, very shortly thereafter because their brains can't handle it immediately at that time. It just takes the slow weakening of the central nervous system over time in order for the brain and the spinal cord to express kind of what they're waiting to break down into.
Now, Dr. Wald, the study also found higher dementia mortality among players in speed positions than among offensive and defensive linemen. What might explain that difference in your eyes?
Yeah, it's from your high school physics course, P equals MV, momentum equals mass times velocity. So it's really simple. It's the faster you're going and the heavier the speed of what is going is traveling. The faster it's going, the heavier it is, the bigger the collision, the higher the impact, and the more the damage there is to the brain. So if you have time to accelerate, then the trauma to the brain is going to be worse. If there's not quite as much room to accelerate, then it's not going to be quite as bad. So, you know, for example, an offensive lineman, they probably hit their head a lot over the course of a game, but they don't build up the kind of speed that maybe a wide receiver or a cornerback might. Definitely does not mean that that an offensive lineman isn't at risk, but they just don't develop that kind of speed. They don't get out into open space and run as fast as they can, sprint in bursts the way that, you know, a receiver or a cornerback might. Though at the same time, what balances that is they generally have less contact. So the speed positions generally have less contact. The outside receivers and the defensive backs tend to have less contact. So there is a little bit of a balance there. But it's just, you know, again, back to your high school physics, mass times velocity is momentum.
Dr. Raphael Judah Wald, a neuropsychologist with Marcus Neuroscience Institute, which is part of the Baptist Health South Florida group, is our guest here on ESPN West Palm today. We appreciate Doc and all his time shedding some light on neurodegenerative diseases. Now, Doc, what's the difference between CTE, or rather, how does chronic CTE differ from Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and ALS? Because you know, people hear CTE, and I sometimes think they get confused on what it actually means compared to maybe some of the other diseases.
Yeah, that's a great question. The core of that, the most important thing for people to take home is first understanding what dementia is. So dementia means, by definition, dementia means that a person has an impairment in their memory and at least one of their cognitive function, at least one of their thinking skill beyond what it should be given their age and how bright they are. So, you know, their memory and their ability to properly see things in space, or their memory and their ability to concentrate on things really hard for a short period of time. That's dementia. It's a memory and cognitive functioning issue. And there are many, 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 many things that can cause dementia, the most common of which is Alzheimer's disease. That's why you hear about Alzheimer's disease so much, because it is the most common cause of dementia. Alzheimer's disease, what we believe is the cause of Alzheimer's disease, is the appearance of two abnormal proteins in the brain that start to show up, again, more frequently. Everybody develops some of them as they age, but in people with Alzheimer's disease, they develop a lot more of them, and that kills brain tissue and eventually leads to memory loss and other kinds of problems with your thinking skills. That's what Alzheimer's disease is. CTE is specifically related to multiple head injuries, right? Not because of these two abnormal proteins. Ultimately, CTE does lead down the road to the appearance of a lot of different abnormalities in the brain, but it's not quite the same way that Alzheimer's disease does. CTE does cause dementia the same way that Alzheimer's disease causes dementia, but it causes it in a different way. And then if you look at it differently, Parkinson's disease, for example, Parkinson's disease doesn't always cause dementia, but when a person does develop Parkinson's disease dementia, it happens because a different kind of an abnormality appears in the brain, and it generally affects a different region of the brain than Alzheimer's disease would.
Now, Dr. Wald, CTE can currently be diagnosed, you know, definitively diagnosed only after death. Say you're treating a patient who you suspect is dealing with CTE. What signs or symptoms might lead to you maybe becoming concerned about a former player who indeed might be, you know, dealing with CTE kind of issues?
Sure. So the things that would lead, and you're dead on there. It's a disorder that's generally diagnosed postmortem. It's done through a brain autopsy, through looking at parts of the brain under the microscope and through seeing the brain as a whole after a person dies. That's really the way that CTE is definitively diagnosed. But in a living person who we strongly suspect has CTE, we make the diagnosis based on an abundance of different information, and that includes their behavior, their thinking skills, the way that their brain imaging looks, what their family members tell us, by ruling out any other possible contributions or causes. Generally, a person with CTE will develop memory loss, and a lot of times what's more unfortunate and what's scarier for a lot of people around them is that they often develop changes in their behavior. So sometimes people develop anger and rage issues. Sometimes people just become more withdrawn. But personality changes are very typical of CTE. So generally speaking, in order to definitively make the diagnosis, yes, it is made after a person dies. But when we strongly suspect someone has it, we can, you know, clearly indicate that we feel that that's what's going on while they're still living.
Now, Doc, say if somebody comes to the Marcus Neuroscience Institute and is dealing, like former NFL player, college player, whoever it may be, and is dealing with CTE, what kind of evaluations, cognitive tests, brain scans, or procedures would you perform to maybe kind of pinpoint what exactly is going on there?
Sure, absolutely. So really, anytime a person is suffering from a question of dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or CTE, there's a standard set of tests that we are going to want to give them. The first one is blood work. And one of the things that blood work does is it helps us rule out reversible causes of the dementia. So, you know, people can suffer changes in their thinking skills because of thyroid disease, B12 deficiency, anemia. There are a lot of different things that are treatable that can cause changes in a person's thinking skills. So the blood work helps with that. They would have brain imaging so that we could look at exactly what their brain looks like. Is the shape of their brain changing? Meaning, is it atrophying? Is it sort of shrinking a little bit? And if so, in what specific ways and in what specific areas? Because different causes of dementia will cause atrophy in different areas of the brain and at different rates. They'll have a neuropsychological evaluation, which will detail exactly what the change is in their thinking skills and determine whether it actually is dementia, right? Because again, with dementia, there has to be a change in a person's memory and at least one other thinking skill. So the neuropsychological evaluation really is what diagnoses the dementia and helps figure out what the cause of the dementia is. Also, physical examination can be helpful if it's a dementia that does affect a person's motor skills. Many dementias don't affect motor skills in the early stages, like Alzheimer's disease does not affect motor skills theoretically in the early stages. Sometimes we will do an EEG, which sort of measures the electrical activity of a person's brain. So that's really the standard set of tests. Mm-hmm. There will be the blood work, a physical exam, neuropsychological evaluation, brain imaging. Those are really the main tests that a person will have. And based on all that, we can come to a conclusion about what we feel is causing the issue.
Dr. Wald, appreciate all the time. A couple more questions here. Now, what can former football players do to protect their brain health? Because, you know, I've known plenty of friends that never played in college, never played, you know, professionally, that have dealt with concussions and have dealt with side effects and stuff like that. So what could you tell maybe former football players that are listening right now that may be dealing with some sort of CTE that could protect their brain health or potentially reduce other modifiable risks for cognitive decline?
Sure. So definitely the biggest and most controllable thing that we can do in order to prevent dementia, slow the progression of dementias, decrease our risk for future dementia. And this includes, you know, CT, obviously you want to avoid head injuries, but generally speaking, the most important thing you can do if a person does indeed have CTE or does have memory loss because of head injuries, most important thing you can do is manage your vascular health. And what I mean by that is any vascular risk factor. So anything that's bad for your heart is bad for your brain. So that means if you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, thyroid disease, sleep apnea, peripheral artery disease, atrial fibrillation, anything that can increase your risk of a heart attack can increase your risk of developing dementia. So For a person who is at risk of developing CTE, the most important thing you can do is partner with your doctor and manage your vascular health. That means getting regular exercise, assuming that your heart is healthy enough to manage it. Getting good regular exercise is one of the most important things you do in addition to managing your vascular risk factors. But, you know, have a conversation with your doctor because that could be different depending on what your health issues are. That could be different from one person to the next. So the name of the game really is, and this goes for CTE, this goes for Alzheimer's disease, this goes for vascular dementia, it goes for many, many other causes of dementia. The name of the game is vascular health.
Dr. Raphael Judah-Wald, a neuropsychologist with Marcus Neuroscience Institute, which is part of the Baptist Health South Florida group, is our guest here on ESPN West Palm today. Now, Doc, I'm sure you know some, you know, family members who might be thinking, or family members, friends, whoever it may be, that might be thinking about maybe signing their son or whoever it may be to tackle football. What do these findings mean for parents trying to decide whether their children should participate in tackle, and particularly at a young age? Where do you stand on that?
Sure. Look, I certainly am not here in any way to tell people not to play football or not to play any other sport. Again, soccer is a sport that has a very high risk of concussion. Ice hockey, rugby, there's a lot of sports with a very high risk of concussion. What I do want to tell people to do is really understand what the risks are. Teach your child, if you want to play tackle football, make sure the equipment fits right. Make sure you're getting the best possible equipment. Make sure that they know how to tackle and they know how to be tackled. Make sure that they understand what the symptoms of a concussion are. Make sure that you understand what the symptoms of a concussion are. You know, a Little League football championship is nowhere near as important as a person's long-term brain health. So if you think a kid is possibly suffering from symptoms of concussion, regardless of how important the game is, pull them out. It's just not worth it. So I'm certainly not here to say whether a person should or should not play a sport. What I am saying is just that people really need to know how to protect themselves. Educate yourself. Don't be a hero. If you are so, you know, if you have bruising, if you have scrapes, cuts, whatever it is, yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can play through. You can be tough. You can be mentally tough. You can play through things. A concussion or a questionable concussion is not one of them. It's not, does not make you mentally tough to play through a concussion. So really just be smart, educate yourself, learn how to play the game properly, and learn how to protect yourself.
Last one here, Dr. Wald, once again, appreciate all the time. What changes would you like to see from, you know, maybe the NFL, youth football organizations, and the medical community to reduce repetitive head impacts and better support players throughout their lives? Is there something maybe that you would do differently or maybe implement right now that might not be there?
Sure. I mean, I really genuinely do think that the NFL, it seems like, has come a really long way. They've done a lot to protect players. It seems like they're investing in protecting players. I think that they understand that their players are their commodity, that, you know, obviously on a personal level, you want to protect them because they're human beings, but also from, you know, if you're going to look at it from in a cold way, that's the players are their commodity. So they want to protect them from that standpoint as well. You know, a lot of it has to do with the technology of the helmets. A lot of it has to do with learning how to tackle, learning what kinds of hits are more likely to cause concussions, because it's not always just the big home run hits that are the ones that cause concussions. A lot of times there are these, you know, if you've ever stood on the sideline of a football game and you've seen, you know, a really minor collision or something that looked trivial that ended up causing a concussion, that's really common. It's super common that a trivial collision ends up causing a really serious concussion. So I think investing in the equipment, investing in continuing to teach the players how to properly tackle and properly be tackled from a very young age, I think that's something that professional football can do, is continue to invest in that. And just kind of paying attention to players and making sure that they're out of the game when there's even a remote suspicion of a possible concussion. Those are really the most important things, to sort of keep doing the things that they have been doing and doing it with some urgency.
Dr. Wald, thank you for all the time, partner, and thanks for helping us shed some light. Well, once again, that was Dr. Rafael Judah Wald, a neuropsychologist with the Marcus Neuroscience Institute, which is part of Baptist Health South Florida. He helped us shed light of the story that came across our desk from Robert Klemko of ESPN.com, explaining that NFL players are four times more likely to die from neurodegenerative diseases. Doc, thanks so much, partner. Appreciate you and hope to talk to you in the near future, okay?
Awesome. Pleasure was mine. Thanks.
That was Dr. Wald. We're coming right back here on ESPN West Palm today.